X is for Podcast Mutants, Magic, and Marvels is brought to you by the Cage Club Network. So for all things media, check out cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me. And for all things X is for Podcast, check out X is for Podcast on Twitter and YouTube.
Kamoda, and welcome back to X is for Podcast, the premier comic podcast for modern Marvels, Chronos Gaming Classics, and more. I'm Nico, and you guys can check me out on Twitter and Instagram at Nico Action. That's NicoAction. Yeah, this was everything I wanted. I can't wait.
And that makes me his miracle compatriot, Kevo, and you can find me over at, you can find me over on the socials at Kevo Really. That's KevoReally.
And I'm Jonah. You can follow me over on Twitter and Instagram at Peak Jonah. That's PEAK, and we hope you survive this experience, unlike Miracle Man, but Miracle Man is still alive.
Well, that has been the running theme of the last 12 fucking years at Marvel. I am so excited to be able to talk today with my two main guys in the whole universe about Miracle Man Zero and Miracle Man the Silver Age number one. Now, we've been talking Miracle Man on this show, Kevo and I, for what seems like forever, with our first ever episode dealing with the Miracle family way back in September of 2019, where we took our first step into the Marvel Man, Miracle Man mythos. And Kevo, it's been an amazing time spending these last 3 years sort of cultivating a Miracle fandom with you.
Absolutely. I can hardly believe that it's been that long since the journey began. You know, there is so much to it. It's such a fascinating universe that I don't really feel like gets the attention it deserves.
Now, it is so exciting for me, Jonah, that you're here to be part of this and cover this with us. When X is for Podcast first began, at this point, an unbelievable 400 episodes ago. That's right. In this episode, we're celebrating our amazing 400th episode, and there could just be nothing better than the long overdue, long awaited miracle revelation that is getting to talk about Miracle Man. So Jonah, when we kicked this off, you and I were talking about Uncanny, and Kevo and I were talking about Captain Britain, and that meant you sort of missed out on this initial round of discussing Miracle Man after all of this time, this 3 years. Does this feel like everything we built it up to be, or are you kind of waiting for the miracle?
To quote Encanto, waiting on a miracle, I don't know if I actually am or not. What I am seeing here is a fascinating character that is a contender for one of the most interesting and roller coaster comic book history in terms of what this character is, who they represent, and their characterization throughout the years. I think I really didn't know what to expect out of Miracle Man, because all I really know about Miracle Man is that he's in one of the most contentious places in comics, in terms of just being able to produce Miracle Man comics, being able to use this license, being able to have this character appear in stories. It is one of those characters that I was like, okay, I don't really have anything to go off of, so I didn't expect anything out of this outside of maybe touching upon that history. And that's kind of what we did. We covered the almost expansive history of Miracle Man, very condensed down, but in a way to make sure to kind of say, well, we're done with that now and we're moving on.
And it's really interesting how much we don't remember that Miracle Man's earliest stories are riddled with a sort of sense of the tumultuous place that Miracle Man is from. As a matter of fact, Miracle Man's origin is kind of in circumventing rights in and of themselves. There was a character, Captain Thunder, and Captain Thunder was super popular, and there were all sorts of problems with the name Captain Marvel, and back and forth, there were rights issues that ultimately led to Mick Angelo, a writer-artist, creating Marvel Man, and he was a British take on the American superhero of the time. And one of the things that really, I think, defines that about it for me is the parallels between Marvel Man or Miracle Man and sort of the conceptualization of Superman or Shazam-y Captain Marvels. I think it's really hard to miss down to the color scheme. And I wonder how much that visual iteration of early Miracle Man with the MM on his chest kind of held him back in American eyes.
I could see that very much so. He probably felt like a bargain version of much better known characters in that regard. Because there were a lot of characters like that back in the day. People who were much shorter lived than Miracle Man, who are completely forgotten because they were just one-offs, basically.
It always makes me think of walking through the mall and seeing what ultimately I would find out are other Era Sentai Rangers in toy packaging and being like, oh, that's a knockoff Power Ranger. Now, Jonah, as somebody who came to this much later, and like I said, sort of through me and my fandom being like, hey, this is a bit of an oddity, a bit of a historical gem that matters a lot to me. Were the visuals of Miracle Man and his compatriots, Young Miracle Man, Kid Miracle Man, and then, you know, the much stranger Warp Smiths, was there any sort of hesitation because the visual is so very British science fiction in the 80s?
Well, no, not completely, because we did cover a little bit of the Alan Moore Captain Britain run, and if I'm not mistaken, that's around the same kind of time period that really, with the introduction of Mad Jim Jaspers and Opal Luna Saturnine and the whole, you know, mission of what Captain Britain is supposed to represent and do kind of across the multiverse, I was sort of familiar enough with the idea of that British 80s sci-fi that I can be comfortable enough to understand what's going on, in a sense of just knowing, okay, there's some familiarity here, I can do this. I do think the iconography of Miracle Man, I think part of it, right, obviously not much can really change at this moment, but I think it comes down to a couple of things being the color choices and lack of like very visual distinction. Miracle Man, looking at what we have, or at least what I read, didn't really seem to stand out in terms of what a superhero design looks like. It kind of does just kind of look like, oh, this is somebody I've probably read because they're just in a spandex suit and they have their letters on them. I probably know MM, Miracle Man, Megamind. I don't know. There's so many acronyms for MM that it actually is kind of funny. And I don't know if that really helps with establishing Miracle Man as a brand.
I agree that the idea of trying to get a foothold on another superhero in this particular color scheme, and then sort of the silly things about it. You know, I personally can't stop saying the name Dr. Emil Gurgunza, but I was looking through some old notes I had, and it's really funny. Evidently, Mick Angelo, creator of Miracle Man and Marvel Man, who Marvel would ultimately purchase the rights from, and Joe Quesada would have a sit down with him in a big interview. He said that the name came from, that's what his brother used to call him. His brother used to say he looked like a Gurgunza and a rather ugly fellow at that. And I just think it's so silly, and it's very funny how we don't even think about these elements, these parts of who these people are that bled into their fiction, that you can see a person's life all over their works. And I think it's a shame that Mick Angelo doesn't get to be part of this magical moment where Miracle Man is finally closer to something than not. But it is just truly incredible that we get to talk about this work that means so much to so many people in so many different ways. And I've been mentioning how this is such a long time coming. Well, the very back of Marvel's first official Miracle Man book, Marvel Man Primer, where they sort of play back and forth with the terminology here, it says, Marvel Man begins in July 2010. Woof. This has been such an extremely slow process, and it's sort of a bummer because Marvel also did a series of premiere hardcover limited editions reprinting early Marvel Man stories. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about why some early Marvel Man stories are a little bit more problematic than need to be discussed, but something I do want to mention is in the back of that primer, you can get an incredible checklist that tells you all of the stuff that you need to know to follow along with Marvel Man from 1954 to 1963. His first appearance was in Marvel Man 25. It was formerly a book called Captain Marvel, but like I said, there were rights issues, naming issues. They needed their own hero, and they came up with Marvel Man, and he ran from Marvel Man 25 to 370. In the 102nd issue of the title in 1955, Kid Marvel Man was introduced. Now the title would run 8 annuals from 1954 to 1963. There would be a 1956 to 1959 Marvel Man 1 through 30, Marvel Man Family 1 through 30, a Marvel Man Family Annual in 1963, as well as Marvel Man Junior Annual and Young Marvel Man 250 to 370. This would feature unbelievable characters who Kevo and I lost our shit over, like Young Nasty Man and Young Gurgunza. This was Young Nasty Man. Oh my God. I know.
Oh my God, Young Nasty Man.
Young Nasty Man. He's everything to me. Oh my God. Oh, so overwhelming how funny he is. Okay. And along with this, they released 6 Marvel Man Family's Finest. These featured stories featuring all members of the Marvel Man family, Marvel Man, Young Marvel Man, Kid Marvel Man, the Marvel Man family, and a Marvel Man serial, a regular storyline that they published. The Marvel Man serial for 6 issues was Gargunza is Kidnapped from Marvel Man and the Great Gargunza Mystery. We also have stories like Marvel Man and the Acid Vapor, Young Marvel Man Meets Young Nasty Man. Oh, I love it. Introducing Kid Marvel Man and more. These 6 issues were covered in 2 episodes, episode 48 and 56 from September and October of 2019. We took a look at those 7 stories in all of their incredible, cheesy, black and white newsprinty glory. The one thing that I remember walking away from, which I'm so excited to see got addressed in the content of this series, was we were really disappointed in some of the, oh, like, look, it's Nazis. Because truly, Nazism and the state of the world and what it wrought, the Holocaust, that's so much more than should just kind of be, haha, Komoda, that's atomic backward. Now I've got superpowers, kind of fodder. And yeah, you know, I kind of do miss these 1960s stories and 1950s stories, but I don't think they're the kind of stuff that people are running out and clamoring for right now.
I think that's fair, but I think that is something that I would say of much of Miracle Man, but in a way where that's, you know, it's still incredibly valid art. It's still incredibly fun stories. And I still think there is an audience. It's just not something that quite has the same mainstream appeal as other titles or other characters or other types of storytelling.
I agree. I do think there's something to be mined there. Now, Jonah, I didn't ask you to read these earlier adventures in a lot of ways because I felt as though if we wanted, you know, a very different thing and I'm asking you to read it, I'm not going to ask you to go out of your way to read like 180 pages of 1950s and 60s serialized, you know, funny strips. Did you feel as though you perhaps lost out for having less of a connection with these characters?
No, not really. And I will say that's because I think the content in this story is trying to not only push a new wave of Miracle Man characters and new additions to this Miracle Man fam, I do think there's kind of the severance of not really trying to discuss or even talk about what happened in the past. You know, one of the titles of this issues that we read is The Secret Backstory of Young Miracle Man. And it's supposed to be the real backstory. This is what really happened. And I think that this is Marvel's way of saying, we're trying to bring this character to a new audience, to a new bunch of readers. We might just need to start fresh and kind of just scrap everything that we had before.
And it's unbelievable because as Kevo and I were discussing it, the material we're looking at today, ultimately, with Miracle Man, The Silver Age, was originally published in 1992, directly on the heels of the previous arc by the same creative team. And, you know, Kevo, to your credit, you were like, wow, this picks up on a lot of things. This remembers where things left off. And I think it's incredible that you haven't read this in 3 years and you remembered where things left off. But and then we noticed how issue 0, a much more recently penned issue, had much less, oh man, that feels just like where we left off.
Issue 0 felt a lot more like it had been written by fans of Miracle Man than properly being truly connected to what was going on at the time. Although this issue 1 did really feel like it felt like a fresh start.
I agree.
Rather than just picking up where we left off, a lot of it did read and feel like a brand new start.
Now, speaking of a brand new start, the rights to Miracle Man had fallen into comic limbo, and when the original writer was given an opportunity to change the course of comic history and write a new era of Marvel Man / Miracle Man, he, along with an incredible bevy of other writers, editors, brilliant artists, transformed comics in a big way, and Marvel printed a number of those first stories across 4 volumes in Miracle Man Book 1, A Dream of Flying. Now, these contain, in part or whole, material from Warrior Number 1 from March of 1982 through Warrior Number 11 through July of 1983. They also contain a number of original back matter materials created since, but lead off with Miracle Man Number 1, Prologue 1956 by Mick Angelo with art by Don Lawrence from August 1985. I know that. We Are Warp Smiths and Miracle Man Special Number 1 from 1984, Saturday Morning Pictures. Now, this arc is the arc that very much establishes this idea of the weight of the Miracle Universe and takes so much of the original canon that was introduced by Michelangelo in the 1950s and radically transforms it. This is where we find out that Johnny Bates is no longer Johnny Bates, but rather is the unfortunate Kid Miracle Man, just the most sinister piece of trash in the universe. And we first see he and Mickey go up against each other. Mickey, being such a flawed man and such a broken creature, is so hard to rectify with what you read in the Silver Age. It's unbelievable to me that as somebody who sees Mickey as this duality of broken and savior, that by Jonah only coming in and reading 0 and 1, I think in a lot of ways, he's sort of circumvented the sadness of Mickey's desperation and now only knows the sadness of Mickey's idolation. And I wonder how that reads, because for me, like, I love broken Mickey overcoming his brokenness, and every time he thinks he should be dead again, he's just not dead. He just can't seem to stay dead, and he has this responsibility to keep going, and the power is corruptively big, and yet he's doing his best to hang on. Yet without that comparison, without seeing her as Marvel Girl, is Jean Grey as the Phoenix ever truly that stunning and terrifying?
Is the Phoenix as much as that Marvel Girl? Or frankly, vice versa, does modern Jean Grey mean as much if you don't understand the full weight of not just the original Dark Phoenix saga, but a lot of the things that have happened since? Because it is so much more than even just the original Dark Phoenix saga. And by starting Miracle Man with 0 and number 1, you have gotten none of Mickey's struggle so far. You can tell there's something there. You can tell there's a heaviness and that there's a lot he's not saying, even just from these first two issues. But the struggle of Mickey is completely gone, except for that one moment of him talking about how he lived as Mickey for 20 years before everything started back up again.
And I wonder so much about the controlled nature of trying to tell this story. The week this drops has a Miracle Man omnibus coming out, and it contains all of the material that we're discussing today from the 1980s run. And so they're putting this out there, and they're making this available in conjunction with the Silver Age. So Mickey's past as a broken man will exist, but it does feel in many ways like there's a clear delineation between the material that was originally released and the material that is being re-released under Neil Gaiman's re-authorship, because don't forget, he is responsible for the last 6 issues of Miracle Man, both in the 90s and now. So there really is a depth and an expanse to how to consider who they want us to see Mickey as, and especially in the multiversal, multifractory reinterpretation of Mickey through the pages of Miracle Man 0. I think we have a lot to talk about in terms of who these versions of Mickey are. The idea that we were given a multiverse experience in a single issue, such that Mickey feels the complexity of other heroes right off the bat, is a testament to the effort they're putting in to shaping an accessibility for this character. From there, we took a look at Miracle Man 5 through 10, which features yet again an unbelievable number of stories, as comics in the 1980s, especially at more struggling companies, had a little bit less 22 pages, that's what you're getting, and a little bit more anthology-like feel. These issues publish Warrior number 13 through 21, and then resume the numbering with Miracle Man 6, and runs Miracle Man 6 through 10. And this is because they were like, okay, this book is catching on, everybody's into Miracle Man, let's make it a little bit more accessible. And so they reprinted a number of those stories in a number of volumes that would make it easier for people to jump in. And, you know, they did their best. You know, like, something I definitely want on the record as well, I don't know, as I wasn't there at the time, I feel like this 1980s crew, the people that were making Miracle Man in the 80s, did everything they could for it. They wanted this book to work. The love, the passion, it's in every page. Now, Miracle Man 5 through 10 would see the introduction of the true origin of Miracle Man and the Gargunza machinations to create a body for himself so that he could live forever, and the reality that the Project Zathura was used to sort of atomic nuke the Miracle family, and that's what left them in a coma for 20 years and broke up the team. There's a lot more in this arc that needs to be mentioned, like the reemergence of the Kid Miracle Man and the defeated Johnny Bates' mind. mind, which is seeking to reassert dominance. Additionally, the birth of Winter, who I think in like a lot of ways is the first like creepy white kid baby in comics. And in her way, she is very much like Captain Britain's daughter and just kind of creepy, knows everything, sits there silently judging everybody with her blonde hair and big eyes. And Winter's real fucking creepy. And I loved this arc. I loved how much of it was Mickey kind of going along with it to see just what Gargunza was up to and how that all affected the course of Mickey's fate, what he came to realize he would need to be. This arc cannot be undersung enough, and it's such a pinnacle moment for the storytelling. And I really love Red King Syndrome for what it provides. Kevo, I don't know if you remember how much of that arc we were like screaming over.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely a fascinating take on the original concept in a way that felt like it was trying to be edgy and subversive, but not going too far over the edge, especially considering the era where it would have been so much easier. So many people were doing so much harder and edgier things. But it really was more about an examination of and new interpretation and recontextualization of the original work.
Now, the following arc, Olympus, features the stories from Miracle Man 11 through Miracle Man 16, as well as a number of behind-the-scenes features and the continued republishing of classic Miracle Man stories. However, we also receive an unforgettable book in the form of all-new Miracle Man Annual, featuring two all-new Miracle Man stories, The Priest and the Dragon, The October Incident, 1966, story by Grant Morrison, art by Joe Quesada, which I just, for the rest of my life, that the two of them collaborated on a book will be the craziest thing, color art by Richard Isenoff, and letters by Chris Eliopoulos, while The Miracle Man Family has Seriously Miraculous by the creative team of, I can't even get through it without smiling, the creative team of Pete Milligan, Mike Alred, Laurel Alred, and Travis Lanham, quite literally my favorite creative team in the history of comics ever to make a book. The X-Men universe knows them best as the creative team behind X-Force Ecstatics. And getting to see that crew do a Miracle Man story changed everything for me. This is the saddest story in all of comics for me. I love Miracle Woman. I love everything she gives us. I love the creation of Olympus and the Age of Miracles. But God damn it, if the loss of Johnny Bates isn't too much for me.
Yeah, that volume was a lot heavier from what I recall.
Losing Johnny is just one of the ultimate comics betrayals, but there's no other way it could possibly go, which is in many ways why when the original writer left and leaves the book in the hands of Neil Gaiman, Neil Gaiman does what he can and reshapes the book. When I say does what he can, I don't mean it's like a meager thing. I mean, like, he does what he can to take the work of a master and build his own masterwork. And the work of Miracle Man, The Golden Age was a very complex thing where Neil Gaiman was tasked with taking a work starting with Miracle Man number 17 in June of 1990 and shaping out a work that would ultimately give us back young Miracle Man. This was done in the backup story, Retrieval, parts 1 through 6. And we talked about this as well as Miracle Man's appearance in Marvel 1000 as our final episode of Miracle Man coverage back in May of 2020. And it's been a long time. We've had little moments like flashes of Timeless where we got a little bit of Miracle Man, but it hasn't been what we've been waiting for, which finally here, the integration of Miracle Man into the Marvel Comics publishing schedule, and I could not be more excited. Now, Miracle Man number 0 sees an incredible creative team across a number of stories, and rather than give the credits all up front, it makes a little bit more sense to discuss the credits as we reach each story. Now, there's no way to discuss Miracle Man at all without discussing Neil Gaiman and Mark Buckingham, the two voices most responsible for bringing Miracle Man back into publishing in so many ways. 1602 only exists because Neil Gaiman was trying to make money for Marvel to help them win the rights to Miracle Man. So it's just so important that this was the story that opened the book, and the art is so powerful. It's so pristine. I maybe wish it wasn't so close to the 1000 story, but Jonah, how did you feel stepping into your first Miracle Man story?
Well, when I was seeing the creative teams and I was seeing these people that I found familiar, I was like, okay, I feel like I'm in good hands. And I will tell you that these Miracle Man stories did not disappoint. It was such a fascinating, almost anthology of all of these different creative teams' interpretations of this one character in a way that felt harmonious. I was really really just pleasantly surprised by how much I enjoyed everybody's take on Miracle Man and the style they wanted to tell their story about him in.
Kevo, I know you'd had some concerns after the Marvel 1000 page. You were kind of like, he's just sitting around reading comics. And I'm like, I know. I wonder if that motif of him sitting and reading our stories is meant to become a transformational point of entry for people. How did you feel about seeing the return to Mickey reading books about Mickey?
I think that it validated using it for the Marvel 1000. I think knowing that it ties to a theme, even if it's just for this Marvel Man, Miracle Man number zero, that still ties it to that in a very important way. This is a very important reintroduction story for the character. It's the first time new people are writing him in so long. And so that really validates it for me a lot more than I had felt about it in the first place.
I'm so excited and eager to see brilliant colorist Jordi Belair adding an unbelievable depth of coloring appropriate to a modern age. Of course, the original colors are standout and spectacular, much in the same way I feel that way about the original Sandman colors, but the representations in the Absolute editions, it's kind of hard to look the other way. Sometimes a modern digital pen can really bring out a lot of the gorgeous that was there all along. And while we're on the subject of Sandman, this book is, of course, lettered primarily by Virtual Calligraphy, the team that does nearly every book at Marvel, with a few exceptions, one of those being Nate Picos of Blambot, who often works with Mike and Laura Alred, as well as Pete Milligan. But this book is lettered by Todd Klein for the Neil Gaiman pages. And Todd Klein did Sandman. So it's just so fucking cool that the guy that lettered Ramadan lettered this. And so I'm just like really in awe. I know he basically just like lettered, but like Todd Klein just like lettering is still like the most fantastic thing ever. I also just want to comment that something that needs to be brought to attention is there's a lot of conjecture about the value of having such a powerful being in charge. And I do agree, you know, everything that Mickey is potentially meant to represent is a danger. And he is certainly not wielding his ability with a fairness or an understanding of his gravitas, I believe. But seeing that he still takes time to learn, that we haven't divorced the god from the man, that's one of the underlying currents that I think sets Mickey's stories apart from other characters who go into that sort of godhood mode. He's still worried about learning and about absorbing and about understanding, which is something that we see yet again in the pages of Silver Age number one. Learning is meant to be done and earned. That is such a core concept to this character, I think in part because his powers were given to him. They were bestowed upon him, so he never earned his powers. So he believes greatness should be earned.
And even more specifically than that, they were put on him without any real regard for who he is as a person. So he really did not earn them himself, and frequently feels the need to be worthy of and to earn this gift that he was given for no absolute reason. He wasn't picked for being any particular, like anything particularly special about him other than just basic physics and being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
It was that no one would miss him.
Yeah. And so I think that is always present in his mind as well. I think that he struggles probably to not just go full immortal, but you can see that there are still flashes there and that there is still, as much as he tries to bury Mickey, Mickey seems to be under them.
Now, Jonah, this actually represents the bulk of all of the true Mickey, Marvel Man, Miracle Man, that central character that is in this book, as the rest of the stories represent a refractory experience of the metaversal ideas that every other character gets to have. Yet Miracle Man, having been held on the shelf for so long, was incapable of sustaining such complex ideas. How do you feel about having so little of the real guy in your number zero?
I think that speaks to a larger metaphorical narrative sense to the comic about the character of Miracle Man and Mickey. Miracle Man and Mickey don't seem to be a identity that is shared between the two. It is almost as if they are two separate characters with two different arcs and stories and characterization. You know, you look at a lot of heroes that their hero or villain identity doesn't differ from their civilian identity all that much. You might have some here or there, you might have Reeves stints and moments where they're able to put aside their heroics or villainry and for a greater cause or a greater good or something. But here it does seem to be that Miracle Man and the responsibilities are diametrically opposed to Mickey as a person. It's such a fascinating detail and says a lot about the character without saying anything. You know, we're just talking about Miracle Man. Mickey himself is a whole separate entity that gets other stories and is talked about in a different way.
Now, to look at the first story, Blood on the Snow, by writer, penciler, and inker Ryan Stegman, with additional inks by J.P. Meyer, colorist by Modern Comics legend Sonia Obak, and letters by VC's Joe Caramagna. I had to read this story like 6 times because I couldn't figure out what I was reading. First of all, Big Ben is like a semi-minor character from the original runs. Like, you know, Kevo, correct me if I'm wrong, but like Big Ben is just kind of like a big mook guy.
Yeah, I really don't remember having read much of him from our time, so I was really surprised by how much focus he ended up getting in this number zero versus characters who I did remember that when I then saw them in number one, I was like, oh, you weren't in zero. Okay.
So I read this story and I was really reading it thinking that this was a Young Miracle Man story. I was going to get a Dickie story. It was going to be so exciting. And so I come to find out that this whole thing is Miracle Man 96, and it's, you know, an original AU Miracle Man, and he's meant to be as 90s as possible. And the art is so hardcore. And that's why we have that line, what will they say when the 2000s come and Miracle Man has ushered in a new century of peace? This is a really funny take on this. It's sort of amusingly a confrontation of the ideas that are in Miracle Man, and what if they were perverted into that silliness that would be unavoidable in the pages of a 90s comic?
Yeah, I know I commented earlier that I didn't think that the 80s Miracle Man stuff that we read ventured too far into edgelording, but you can see where it easily could have, especially given the tone of the 90s.
Now, how did you feel, Jonah, about interacting with this new idea of Miracle Man already in the form of Miracle Man 96?
I think this was a really good start for somebody who hasn't read any Miracle Man before, because it feels, you can kind of tell, this is meant to be a continuation story. You know, you have players and characters that are already established. This seems like it's something that's trying to pick up right after the events of a previous comic. So having it, the entire issue start here, I think was a really great move to help. Even if they don't explain anybody anything, it still gives you that sense of familiarity where you're like, okay, I can kind of pick up from clues what exactly is going on here. There's plenty that's being said here that's not directly told to us that we can infer as readers that help us understand what the story is about and where it takes place time-wise, not literally.
I thought that the idea that we're getting this Miracle Man of 1996 with this Big Ben of 1996, the whole thing was a really fun way to, I guess, catch up on lost time in a book that's always vaguely about catching up on lost time. And that's why the Miracle Man, the animated series, Saturday Mornings, Check Your Local Listings, Ty Templeton advertisement, I was immediately in the 90s. This was so well thought. This really does create the context for the fact that the book was kind of, this would have been like a 90s title. Now, admittedly, I am a very big Warp Smith fan, and I'm a very big Mike Carey fan. And so Whisper in the Dark from the Case Files of Jaxa Gunn by Mike Carey, Paul Davidson, Antonio Fabela, and VC's Joe Caramagna was one of the highlights of this book for me. The noir style, the Warp Smith with the warp gun, this unbelievable take on Kid Miracle Man with Wednesday Morning. So it's a lot of the same themes, but it's interpreted in a different way. It's got this 2000s gritty crime comic to it. It's got all of these cool Kirbyan contrasts and ideas. There's nothing I don't love in this story. I felt from the start, getting a Warp Smith story was really a great way to make this feel like a bigger book than it was. Jonah, how did you feel about being introduced to a whole new race of creatures with the Warp Smiths?
I was completely fine with it because Marvel themselves are very peachy keen to kind of explore the vastness of space through their comics. So truly, you can just name, you can string along a sentence of random letters and phrases and say it's a new alien race and give them a design. I go, yeah, but that's Marvel. That's a Marvel alien. Yeah, that makes sense to me. It doesn't faze me, but I do get excited by it because I do like seeing the way that artists and all the entire creative team can push the boundaries of character design where they're not constrained to human slash humanoid.
I agree. I love the design elements of the Warp Smith. I feel that this story has a lot of things that like I probably would have loved a bit more of in classic Miracle Man. Kevo, how did you feel about dialing into the Warp Smiths?
I thought that this title was probably the most standout one from this issue. I think head to tail from the writing, the art is absolutely amazing. I think that it played with a lot of the established concepts in the Miracle Man lore in really fun ways, while also still being incredibly creative and ingenuitive. I really hope that we get to see more in the Miracle Man verse from Mike Carey, because he really, really has everything about this world down. I love that you compared Wednesday to Johnny, because honestly, I would compare this character to Winter. I thought that this kid was one of the creepy miracle kids that are part of this new generation. And I think it goes to show the many different avenues through which this miracle power can be dangerous, whether it is someone like Johnny or it is someone like one of those kids.
I love that take on it. I really think that is a great perspective. And, you know, Jonah, as a formerly young, precocious person and now just a sort of young, sort of precocious person, how do you feel about Wednesday? Where did this character fall in the grand scheme of the tradition of creepy Marvel kids for you?
So I am of the mindset that Wednesday is the alternate universe Marvel version of Wednesday Adams, but Wednesday Adams is just an all-powerful being spent on spreading cathartic madness throughout different races among the expansive universe, and that's nothing like Wednesday Adams, but I just find it funny that they're both named Wednesday. I thought this version of Miracle Man was such an interesting take in the sense of it's so bizarre, and I knew going into this that Miracle Man's morality and good versus evil has been very flip-floppy, but this one seems strictly manipulative and evil. And I thought that was an interesting take where we have a Miracle Man that is strictly about spreading chaos.
Okay.
And I do really get that vibe. One of the things that, coming at it from like, this isn't a take on something that you know, but rather you're seeing pieces that you're aware of. That's a really transformational interpretation that for me really helps to redefine looking at it from the opposite end.
That supposition is really a marriage between Maya Nico's separate interpretations as well. It's the meeting between the idea of a Johnny and the idea of a Winter's child, you know, becoming something completely different itself as well.
All in all, one of the things that this story delivered was big science, but it still came down to basic ideas. The idea that the Whisper is sort of a viral word, like a mental pathogen, and that it makes Wednesday so unstoppable that given another few moments, he might have managed to overtake everything, but instead the Warp Smith does what he has to do and he warps the bullet into the internal organs of Wednesday. It's a really powerful reminder of what a Miracle Man has to do, of what a Miracle Man's job is, of what a Warp Smith's job is, of what these characters whose job is to have this great caliber of power in this world where they're defined by these moralities, whether we agree with them or not, their job is to kill something so that it can't become the greatest evil that the world has ever been faced with. I think that's a definitive thing that runs as a current of morbid responsibility. You know, Spider-Man is all like, oh, with great power, there must also come great responsibility, Uncle Ben. And, you know, Superman is like, my cum can blow up walls. But like with Miracle Man, it's sort of like, I have to kill people and I'm always sad. And it's a very different take on brooding masculinity, self-sadness sort of take. Now, on a much happier note, no, actually, I think they're all sad, but the Miracle Funnies were adorable, and then I read them, and then they weren't cute anymore. So, okay, Doomed and Buried is such an amazing bit of humor.
Oh my god, everything about it.
Where they're trying to save London, because I've literally thought to myself, you know, there's got to be a burning city beneath Olympus, you know? And the city is burning, and one guy is like, I can't fucking stand these superpowered people. They've got this whole power. And the guy's like, hey, they've also got super hearing, man. And so then they change their conversation to, well, I, for one, welcome our sparkling overlords. What an oh, so good.
That line always amuses me because it is such a Simpsons meme line. So when I see it referenced in something else, especially in this bizarre context of a fake cartoon strip for a 1980s, 1990s reimagining of a 1950s, 1960s cartoon. Like, everything about it is just so random and circular.
Now, one of the things that, Jonah, I want you to know, these sorts of pages, this was not, like, super prevalent in Miracle Man. This is just sort of them trying to give the meta-contextualization that I feel like every other Marvel hero would have had in the course of their lifetime. And these sorts of Saturday morning cartoon strips are really unique to this, as is their art style. And, you know, again, huge kudos to Ty Templeton on the depth of his work here. Now, Bates in Hell is crushing and mind-numbing and incredibly painful. It is Kid Miracle Man, the super villain version of Johnny Bates, torturing Johnny Bates in hell, it would seem. And it seems like it's drawn to look like Homer and Bart. And this is horrifying.
Yeah, and look, you can do shit like that, but then you need to pay it forward. So now I need, like, some good stuff to happen to Johnny, or else you can't do shit like that to me. Sorry, not allowed. Yeah, that groaning style, very much so.
And I'm so glad that they used Big Ben for the Little Nemo thing, because not my shit. Never my shit. Like, and like, I love Little Prince. That's my shit. And I like Pagemaster with Macaulay Culkin. That's my shit. But I just don't get that, like, Little Nemo in Slumberland thing. I don't get it. And I think the Big Ben thing is a tribute to that. And I don't get why we're Big Benning at all. So
that's the thing about it, though. I don't get why it's Big Ben. Like, why wasn't that Winter or Miracle Woman or I don't know. Literally make someone up. I don't care. But this focus on Big Ben in issue zero was so bizarre. So bizarre.
But then we had Komodo Cat.
Yeah, that was great.
So that's my favorite Warpsmith design, right? Super beautiful. And we have Komodo Cat. And, you know, I really genuinely loved this silly little meta Kimota. And we get, you know, Miracle Man, who I guess is Miracle Mouse. And that's how we get to, but it's Komodo Cat. So, like, Komodo Cat has an MM on their chest. Jonah, were any of these comic strips of any value to you interpreting
coherent?
These characters?
Were they coherent for you at all?
Coherent? No. Enjoyable? Yes.
Okay.
These look like they're harkening back to, you know, the cartoons in newspapers. You know, that's my first thought of is your Sunday morning cartoons, you know, or I guess they weren't. The Sunday morning cartoons is something. I'm confusing things. Let me take that back. This kind of page, the spread of comics just really kind of harken back to the idea in the art style of comics that you used to read in newspapers. I'm pretty sure that's still a thing. I don't know how many more younger audiences know about that or actually know it's where, like, a lot of different media's come from.
So the last story in Marvel Man Zero, The Man Whose Dreams Were Miracles, this story is by Jason Aaron with pencils and inks by Lionel Francis Yu, colors by Sunny Go, and letters by VC's Joe Caramagna. One of the things that I want to point out about this story is the internet dubs them Miracle Man Red and Miracle Man Blue, these two other Miracle Men that are battling Dr. Solomon. I think that's an interesting reference possibly to the 1990s Superman Red, Superman Blue era, where Superman was split into two creatures. And I mostly find the fight short, sweet. This is a very interesting statement on these characters. I love these stories. I think they're really good. I think they're a lot of fun. I think that this sort of bigger than life, self versus self versus self kind of story, it really drives me to some interesting places that I wonder what would have come in earlier stories. I wonder what would have been if Miracle Man hadn't been so off limits. For that reason, I'm really excited that Jason Aaron told this story that gave us sort of like a Miracle Man versus Miracle Man to sort of get it out of the way. I hope then that we can avoid doing like a Miracle Man multiverse smash-up. We just kind of got it in a really easy to digest way. I feel pretty good about that.
Do anything to deter that? It's not that this was specifically not good for me. I just don't really think it landed the way they intended for me. Automatically, it not being a real person kind of took a lot of the bite out of doing a story like this for me. I don't know, because it's hard. Do you make it a real person or not? Because then if you do make it that real person, you're like, oh, well, why them? It's just a very tricky story to do, which is why I definitely, like you, hope that I hope that this was the goods. I hope that this isn't a well that they try to mine over and over again. I'd be willing to ride it out, you know? I would be interested to see this carry into something larger. If there's a good plan for it, I'm open. But it's not really something that I'm clamoring. I'd rather it stay a little bit more intimate and focused on the characters that we already know.
Now, to the characters that we already know, we're here to take a look as well at Miracle Man Book 5, The Silver Age, number 1, which was originally published in The Secret Origin of Young Miracle Man in Miracle Man number 23, June 1992. There's also an enormous sketchbook in the back, which was super great to see. And I love that this book starts off in the year 2003. It's almost hard to say. I'm like, the year 2020. Oh God, this is in the past, right? 2003, the 19 EM in the Age of Miracles. This, do you know where your children are in terms of this big picture of children? Who are the children? Who are the next generation? Is young Miracle Man still a child? The complexity of this conversation is so prevalent throughout the book that ending the first page with such a decisive conversation starter really is a powerful narrative point for the series.
I was a little jarred by the opening as well, though. I think that is frequently their intent with Miracle Man stories. However, I think that they want you to feel a little bit off center and not really have your bearings, especially when they are reintroducing a character like Dickie and everything that goes with that. They want you to feel a little bit as clueless as the character themselves.
Now, Jonah, how did you feel about the enormity of this story, waking up into the Age of Miracles, settling into this enormous battle with these otherworldly creatures that's somehow immediately worth breaking up simply because someone's gonna wake up?
It was one of those things where I really didn't understand what was going on, especially when Duncan, in one of his shapeshifter forms, came out. I was like, is that Lord Z from Spellbinders? No, this would be the weirdest place to put him. I guess it kind of makes sense. And I was like, oh no, it's also not Galactus, it's somebody different. And this is one of those things where it kind of just keeps you completely out of the loop, because we're not here to talk about these miracle kids, we're here to talk about Miracle Man. And I found these kids so fascinating that there's still so much mystery that I kind of almost wish we got a little bit even more about them, because I don't know if there's really enough to make any conclusive, concrete opinions, because we barely got a little bit about everybody, except that we can all agree Kay is right by saying she wants to have sex with Miracle Man.
Yeah, no, sex with Miracle Man is always the right choice.
I feel like you can even glean what is going on with context clues. Like the fact that this is clearly the island of Manhattan, but it is an island in the South Pacific. The fact that they are playing at throwing skyscrapers at each other and no one is upset, no one seems harmed. My context understanding is this is a fake city. This is a place where miracle children go to play act being omnipotent superpowers and throw buildings at each other. And that's why they even have the statement of, we just have to make sure it's cleaned up by tomorrow, because they can do that because they're miracle children. It's just, this is their form of play. But the fact that they didn't go out of their way to specifically explain what was going on, it can be very confusing, especially when we then jump to something completely different. I hope that we get more context for that and for what exactly we are supposed to take from it, but I don't know. This is also frequently a hit the ground running title. You know, when we got to reintroducing all the characters and Dickie meeting everyone, and I'm looking around at that giant giant garden with the sculptures and the images, and I'm reminded of the many clones of Andy Warhol, and there's just so much running in the background already, and it's going to be a lot.
And I think that's sort of the nature of the game here. Dicky is still stuck in a modus that is a different language style, a different text speak, and the way he interacts with Mickey is so fascinating, because Mickey is speaking in modernized language and modernized convention, whereas Dicky is still stuck in a sort of old mode, both in character and in the way he speaks, to the point where when he transforms back, he says, "I want my mom." Like, he is so stuck in his past that it's so difficult to begin to see how this character can overcome some of this, whether it's discovering that he never really fought the Nazis, something we did comment was problematically handled with sort of a silliness almost, or it's the way that we see him have to ask about Johnny a few times. There really is a depth to this that is worth investigating, and I'm excited to see Neil Gaiman and Mark Buckingham go on this journey.
Were all 6 issues of this originally written back in the 90s, or is this something where, as production fell off, scripting fell off?
You know, I can't say for sure, and even then, I couldn't say that that would be the product that we get. I'm certain that we're going to get a product that is reflective of what is best for the story now, and I know that only the first 2 issues, this issue and the following, were released originally, so it's hard to know if it was written.
Okay, and even then, how much it might have been edited in the process of finally producing this.
I think Dicky being so lost is indicative of how the Miracle Man property was so lost for so long. It's in that vein, in that storytelling perspective, that one of the things that I'm most excited to see is the confrontation of what a super god was once upon a time and what it is now. Is Dicky strong enough to stand up to Mickey should something happen? Should it be necessary? Or is Dicky likely to somewhat react at the state of things? We've already seen once that a miracle person given too much power can be a danger, and it would be interesting to see if it was handled in a very different way to a different end under a new creative team. So, Jonah, Kevo, I'd love to get your guys' final takes on the issue.
I'm really fascinated with the Miracle Kids and the way that they're kind of viewing this as story time, almost as if they are watchers in and of themselves of how is this going to play out. I want to know what their specific fascination with Miracle Man is outside of just general interest. I wonder if they're meant to be the audience stand-in of how we look at Miracle Man through the lens of his life and so on and so forth. I do want to know a lot more about them. And I also really want to know more about the interdynamic relationship between young Miracle Man and regular Miracle Man. I do think they had a very interesting relationship in what we saw that I'm really interested in seeing how that dynamic continues. I also really need to know, will young Miracle Man get better? Because the way he reacted to the other members of Olympus is a big ol' oof. But you have to remember, this is a man who's been frozen in time for, since what, the 50s?
It's been such a tough time the last few years, and Miracle Man has had such an uphill battle. I look forward to taking a look at Miracle Man, the Silver Age 2-6, and I just can't wait to see how this shapes out for a modern audience under a modern re-envisioning.
Yeah, I wasn't absolutely the happiest with how little I felt there was in this first issue at times, but it's part of an arc, and I still feel like we got a lot of interesting things and a lot of interesting lead-ins for more. You know, they could have just had Dicky wake up at the end of this first issue, and that would have been frustrating in a different way. But instead, we got to see a little bit of his perspective on this new world, and now we have a lot more space in the second issue to get more of him, and that has me really excited to see what we're going to end up getting.
Buzz Buzz Babies, it's Blake from Blake's Buzz, and I just want to wish a very special happy 400th episode to all the great people at X Is For Podcasts. If you guys like anything I do at Blake's Buzz, it's because these guys taught me how to loosen up, how to be myself on the mic, and just how to have fun talking about comics. I owe these guys so much. They're always so incredibly friendly and useful to the community. If you have X-Men or Marvel questions, they're always happy to answer, and they're just the best of people celebrating the best of what Marvel is doing right now. I hope you all have 400 more episodes, 800 more episodes, 1200 more episodes. I hope you keep going forever because what you bring to the community is priceless and I appreciate all of you. Excelsior, baby.
Hey everybody, this is Jonah, and you can follow me over on Twitter and Instagram at PeakJonah, and we hope you survived this 400th episode experience. Wowie, wowie, wow. Holy moly, hot dog. This is quite the accomplishment, and I am so incredibly thankful for the opportunity to be able to express my thanks to not only to all of our amazing contributors and cast members who I have met some of the most wonderful people, and I'm so thankful for every single person's contribution, their knowledge, their experience, their perspective, their thoughts, their opinions, everything that makes them wholly unique. I've met some truly wonderful and incredible people, and I'm so thankful for that. And I'm also just thankful that I have the opportunity to get to talk about comics. I think that's just really neat that I have this platform, no matter what it may look like, that I get to just talk about my opinions and feelings on a medium that I've fallen in love with for the past 2 years. And I just think that's really cool. 400 episodes is, that's a lot. That is so many, that's like an original comic runs, you know, that's a number that old comic runs used to get to, but they don't get to that high anymore. And to think that I've spoken for so many hours and that it's all just out there for anyone to listen to is so wild and crazy to me. I want to thank everybody who's a listener and a fan. You guys are incredible. You are part of the reason that I keep doing the show is that I know that there are people listening who want to hear what everybody has to say. And you guys are just incredible. You keep listening. We keep pumping out the content. And I look forward to personally trying to create more things so that everybody can find something that's really great for them to listen to and that they can really just latch onto. I also want to do a very specific shout out to Nico. You know, we started this podcast so long ago just because I wanted to talk about Nightcrawler, and to think how far we've come and how much the show has grown. I could not have done this without him in any sense of the imagination for how much he contributes, but just, you know, it's really cool that we got to do this together and it's grown to what it is today. And that's really special. And I'm really, you know, I'm glad that I get to keep doing this. So.
Hey, everybody, it's Nico. And as always, you can catch me at Nico Action. That's NicoAction.
Hey, gang, it's Nathan. You can find me at Dazzler AOA on Twitter. That's Dazzler, like an Age of Apocalypse.
This is such an exciting 400th episode special. Like, I'm over the moon, and there would be no possible way to have this incredible exploration of what we've been doing for the last few years go a step further without, I think, two things that, you know, Nathan, you've made hallmarks of our show. Number one, Nathan, and number two, Peach Momoko.
It's really amazing to think how, when I first read the Demon Days backup story and what was it, King in Black, I was like, oh, ooh, this is gonna be good. Like, before, I was like, never really super excited about AUs, and I was like, oh my gosh. Then when I get the first Demon Days X-Men, I'm like, holy shit, this is amazing. And it hasn't disappointed me since.
Yeah, it's unbelievable to think that we've been carrying this like Peach Momoko verse in our hearts for like several years now, and we were so lucky to have Zach Davison, Ariana Marr, and Peach Momoko on the show. And now we have an unbelievable opportunity to discuss a Peach Momoko story featuring Zach Davison and Ariana Marr, this unbelievable trifecta creative team, like the holy trinity of Marvel horror comics, right? And it's about Miracle Man, who I talk way too much about. But Nathan, what's your relationship with Marvel's newest, you know, super figure?
So my relationship is so loose. Like, the only time I really ever noticed Miracle Man before in the past was in some Captain Britain stories from back in the day where Linda McQuillan was married to the sidekick of Miracle Man.
Oh man, I love that. Okay, yeah, I'm gonna go with the sidekick of Miracle Man. I can't argue it. I don't know what else you'd call young Miracle Man, so yeah.
Yeah, that is my real Miracle Man, like, before this whole issue here, picking up the Silver Age that just came out. Those issues just came out. So before that, I was like, I never really heard of Miracle Man. I knew who Miracle Man was. I knew how excited you were, Nico, when Timeless came out and they were like, Miracle Man's coming.
Yeah, that was my entire New Year's, I think. That was such a big thing for me. And I love that you brought up Dickie Dauntless, who is one of my favorite Miracle characters. I love Young Miracle Man. Of course, there's Miracle Man, Kid Miracle Man, and Young Miracle Man. There is also Miracle Woman. And each one of them is a separate, incredible creature. Miracle Man being Mickey Moran, Kid Miracle Man being my precious Johnny Bates, and Miracle Woman being Avril Lear. Now, properly, those three characters reside in what is considered Earth 18. Earth 18 was given the designation for the Miracle Universe, or the Marvel Universe that existed from Eclipse and Fawcett Comics over in the UK. But Dickie Dauntless, my precious Richard, he is certainly from Earth 18, but the adventures of Dickie Dauntless as they pertain to Earth 18 are unfolding in the pages of Miracle Man, the Silver Age, as we speak. And Nathan, you brought up such a pivotal thing for my fandom for this character. The Dickie Dauntless from the Captain Britain universe is from World 238, and he is a different Miracle Man. In his world, he is like the Miracle Man. And it's so amazing because it is one of the things that got me interested in the story. And I only was ever able to get it because I worked at a comic shop and they walked in one day and I was like, this is something I've always wanted to see. And the owner was like, yeah, no one's heard of that book. You can buy. And so I bought like all of my copies of the original run by Alan Moore for like $1 a piece. And oh, so lucky. I mean, you know, the condition is the condition, but I'm so grateful. And, you know, hearing that despite not knowing each other for years, and despite the fact that it was, you know, hundreds of miles apart, that we both have this specific memory of this moment in fandom that like changed the way we interacted with something. It's just really cool.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's so cool. It makes sense, right? I mean, we're both big Captain Britain fans. You know, like, we probably both have that touchstone. And I love that, like, didn't she get to depose Saturnine with Dauntless too? And I was like, yes.
Yeah, when they reappear in Captain Britain Volume 2, Number 14. I love this character and his unbelievable amount of canon for two appearances. And one of them, he's dead. Like, it is interesting because when you come to find out all of the things that go into like creating Miracle Man and how everything happened, it's so complicated. But it has somehow been stated somewhere in canon that this Miracle Man, this young Miracle Man, Dickie Dauntless from 238, does not swap bodies with an alternate self, which is like a key element of how the miracle powers work. So that implies to me that the Dickie we love from this thread connection to Excalibur via Captain Britain and his appearance in Daredevil's Number 7 from 83, it's so cool. I don't know. It's just that way that multiversity has always been at the heart of who Miracle Man is.
Yeah, that's cool. I did enjoy reading through this whole issue and learning more about Miracle Man. And I was like, okay, cool. I think I can read more. Definitely down to read more.
I would love to see everybody find like a miracle story that makes them happy. Not that there's a whole lot of happiness and a whole lot of Miracle Man stories. It's a bummer. It is a really big bummer. And I want to point out that what's really interesting is World 238 has a unique distinction in history. When Dave Thorpe, the guy who was masterminding Captain Britain before Alan Moore and then worked with Alan Moore in that capacity, when he numbered the universes, he numbered the world that Dickie Dauntless and Mad Jim and, you know, Linda McKillen comes from, Earth 616, because he wanted it to basically be the mark of the beast, like 666, but wanted to make it some number less where you'd know that it was close to as evil as possible, but not quite. And when Alan Moore took over for Dave Thorpe, he was like, nope, this one gets 238. I'm keeping 616 for myself. And that's where the 616 universe came from, Dickie Dauntless.
Wow, that's crazy.
Just a weird little bit about how that trivia, just it's everywhere.
Wow. Oh, that's so cool. I do always love that fact that Earth 616 first came from a Captain Britain comic. Like, what?
And it's like Alan Moore is the guy who most hates superhero stuff now. Something I know that a little bit more in the present with AUs, Demon Days has been a book that you've really connected with and you've had a really strong emotional relationship with, whether it's been the X-Men titles or now moving on to the bigger Marvel Universe. And I was wondering if you could like say some of what it is about Peach Momoko and Zach Davison and Ariana Maher, this trifecta of incredible talent that so draws you in.
I think it's part the fantastical horror that Peach's art conveys, the drawing from Japanese folklore. Not only are you getting very entertained and you have the Oni files at the end, you can learn a little bit about the stories you just read and, you know, how they would relate to actual folktales. And it's a lot to do with how, like, I think the team is so synergistic. Like, I think that, you know, without Ari's lettering, like, the book wouldn't be as amazing. I think without, you know, Zach Davison's, you know, help to, you know, guide the dialogue, it wouldn't be as amazing. Like, of course, Peach could just put out this beautiful thing, which we would all want to consume. But I think they are all elevated by, like, their synergism that they have. And it just becomes this, like, magical creation. Love the horror, love the whimsy, and I love the takes that they have on characters.
I really agree. There's something about the tremendously unique takes they have on these characters that really draws me into their narrative. And when I got a chance to sit down and read The Miracle of Kimoda, the story of the only story of Miracle Woman in the whole book, and the only story that really verges on a, like, fantastic sort of spirituality, I just knew this was the right fit. Now, I know that many readers had some confusion about the multiverse setup of this book, but once you were able to dial into the uniqueness of this story, even with the limited Miracle Man that's available, how did you feel about seeing this idea of Peach, Zach, and Ariana moving the horror needle into this world?
With my limited exposure, it didn't feel like as maybe like jarring of change as it would for maybe somebody who's more drawn into just Miracle Man and wanted to read the Peach story. I think that it was able to draw me in and make me want to know more about these characters in a way that a story really hadn't done before with Miracle Man. Besides wanting to know more about Linda McQuillan's husband.
I am so thrilled that you and I get to talk about the nature of the feminine voice in the Miracle world, because Miracle Woman is one of the only characters in this universe. And for that reason, one of the only female characters in this universe. And for that reason, it really does make discussing her so important, even in this sort of alternate universe we find ourselves discussing her. Now, had you been aware of the fact that there were major female characters in the Miracleverse?
I think I was only aware of it through the fact that she's shown up on a few of the covers, but I think with this one shot, especially as introduction, I don't think that you can realize how big of a character she could be. Like, I feel like she looks like, when I've seen her on the covers, she looks like she's a pretty important character. But besides this story, she isn't even mentioned or shown in the book. And I do like how this story made her a very important part of the character. And I'm wondering, like, and I want to know more, because she's rad on this beautiful cover I have, where she's Terry Dobson cover, where she's just like leaning into Miracle Man. And I love the sort of Destiny-esque look that Peach took with her on this issue too.
I can't help but think she did a really beautiful job redesigning the character. It's so exciting. And I love just how not remotely Miracle Man this is. There is nothing about this that is even a little bit Miracle Man. Good. Fucking good. Because just about everything Miracle Man has been created by a group of heteronormative white creators. Male creators. And while I love so many of these stories, I can't help but wonder how much better they would be for the fact of outside voices from that incredibly narrow bubble coming in and saying, your story's cool. This would be even cool. Or, your story's cool, here's another way to be cool. It's not always about one-upsmanship, but man, getting to see a woman's take, whether it was Ariana, Jordi Belair, or Peach Momoko in this issue, was just thrilling.
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. You can tell that she took the time to explore the other supporting characters that are in his cast. Like, reading the other stories, like, yeah, maybe I get a little bit more of a glimpse into Miracle Man himself, even though they're all alternate realities, but, like, I don't get any of the importance of the supporting characters in his life. Like, from the rest of the stories, he seems, you know, he's presented in a very solitary way, and this at least presents him as a pair, as not just being an entity onto himself needing a support cast.
Because one thing this story really didn't have was characters. It had concepts, and I feel in that way the concepts the creative team laid out for us really told a story about the nature of mysterious enchantresses, mysterious god figures, men desperate desperate for something greater out of their sad lives. Because one more time, Mickey was pathetic. I think I've said it every 5 minutes in this episode, but Mickey is pathetic until he's Miracle Man. And then he's a special kind of pathetic. But I really was so enamored and raptured by the idea that these characters would be moving somewhere so dynamic and powerful. It's just really thrilling.
I gotta say, I love like the horror visual she used in this, like the maggots eating away at, I guess, his old body to transform into his new body. And then the eyes that are popping out and just like how bloodshot everything is. It's so terrifying, that transformation sequence.
I thought that that was one of the smartest thing they were able to come up with. The reimagining, the revisualizing of these abstract ideas. You know, when Miracle Man was done, and don't get me wrong, you know, every other story by Alan Moore involves somebody turning into a giant slug eating a planet. I don't know. But he definitely was not the same storyteller that somebody like Peach is. I feel like the TV in the background speaking, you know, the way that Zach was able to create such perfect lines of dialogue, Ariana's stunning work making the letters part of the framing, using them so carefully. There's such mastery to this book. And I really, the big thing for me is I will be broken if this is the only time we see these alternate universe.
Oh, that'd be so tragic. I really got to see where these stories go. Like all of them, like they've all got a fascinating hook, especially the Demon Days Momokoverse story. Like I really need to see this Miracle Man come back and crawling out of the ear of a body. Yes. And like just grow and have Kimota give him exactly what he wants, grants him.
And for that reason, for all of those pieces, I am so grateful that we have been able to build this unseeable world, right? Like when we talk about something on this show and you guys in the Midnight Mission are like, man, we love Defenders. We want to talk Defenders. And then Defenders Beyond has. And suddenly Defenders Beyond has Loki, who's all of a sudden showing up in Iron Fist, which we've also been covering, which also fit with the fact that we've been covering White Fox, which connected to the death of Doctor Strange, which connects to Defenders. There's such a beautiful synergy, and the idea that Demon Days and Miracle Man, that could all come together is just such a perfect reason our show is so magic, and I'm just so glad we got to talk about this story.
Oh, same. It's always a joy, especially when you get to, for me, as a fan of Peach, having me want to learn more about a new character, and it's got to be a joy for you as a huge fan of Miracle Man, just coming in and seeing Peach, you know, radically redesign the character, but in such a fun, beautiful, and horrific way.
So Nathan, you know, I expect to be on this show another 400 and then another 400 after that. And I expect to see you here with me for all, I think we just said 800 episodes that are coming, and better start planning them. But, you know, it's so exciting to get to be part of this show with you and to get to talk about this with you and your amazing partner and running these rooms and cultivating the relationships the way we do. You know, each one of us does our own part of that. And I know I could never do what you do. And I love the way over the last 400 episodes, I mean, I think a little bit more appropriately 250, because the show was different the first 150 or so. But, you know, 400, let's just count it, because I think minute for minute, you're like tied with me for most. So, you know, let's just call what it is. You know, I just want to thank you for everything you've done for this whole time. And just, you know, on behalf of me and all the fans of X's for Podcast, I know we're all so grateful for the work you do.
Oh, it's been. A pleasure and a blast. I gotta say, it's been about 2 years now since I've been on, and it is,
oh yeah,
I have come into my own in a way that I never would have imagined. And I gotta thank everybody who stuck around to listen to us, as you know, we've started off and stumbled and fall, but we always got back up and we've learned and grown, and you know, we've been able to meet fantastic creators that we've always dreamed of meeting. I know for me, I've got to have those comic book store conversations that I never had a chance to have when I was a kid. And especially as a queer growing up, you know, you don't always feel 100% safe in those environments. But it's been so great to be able to come on with a bunch of like-minded people and just have these wonderful discussions. And yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. We hope everybody enjoys listening to it as much as we like enjoy making it.
And we love making this show for you 3 times a week, every week. week, featuring all sorts of stories covering the Marvel Universe, alternate universes, chrono-skimming classics, and more. You can check the show out at xsforpodcast.com and xsforpodcast on Twitter.